morning. My name is Ben. I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our guest speaker today, Steve Hagen. Steve is the founder and guiding teacher at Dharma Field Zen Center, which is all the way across this lake, the David Costa. It's a wonderful practice place. If you haven't been there, I recommend going by. Steve originally practiced here in this place and received Dharma transmission from Katagiri Roshi. I just learned that Steve's first Dharma talk was 42 years ago in the fall in this very room. Yeah.
It was my first public talk ever. I was scared to death. I'm still scared.
Steve is also the author of numerous wonderful Dharma books and the editor of Katagiri's book, You Have to Say Something, and some really wonderful Dharma books, including Buddhism Plain and Simple, Buddhism Is Not What You Think, and the forthcoming next summer, The Grand Delusion. So please help me welcome Steve Hagen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Well, this morning, I thought maybe I'd talk about... Can you all hear me okay? Sometimes my voice kind of sinks a bit, so I'll try to keep it up. This morning, I thought I would talk about the three refuges. Maybe you're familiar with those. And they're part of the 16 precepts that we take... here in our Soto Zen lineage, Zen school. And so they're pretty important. And there's a number of things that we can think and consider about these first three precepts. When I give lay ordination, we go through the 16 precepts. But with the first precepts, I take a little bit of time to explain these precepts a bit. These are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And I think it's very difficult for us to really get the sense of how these are to be taken or what this term refuge means. Because in our language, in our culture, taking refuge is like we're seeking for something outside of ourselves that will give us protection and, help us in some way. This was a very common idea in India long before the time of the Buddha, even. And people there, they had this idea of taking refuge. But they would take refuge in their various gods for various reasons, to protect their crops or their family or whatever it might be. And so they would rely on these various entities, deities that they believed would support them and help them. And they could take refuge in them. And that sort of was an idea that was very prevalent in India at the time of the Buddha. But it can also seem like it leaves us kind of dependent on something other than ourselves. It leaves us other dependent. And the Buddha, I don't know if you're familiar at all with the Kakaya Nagoda Sutra, it's pronounced differently in various ways, whether it's Sanskrit or Pali or whatever. But in this sutra, he's asked a question about right view, the Buddha is, and the Buddha responds with a response. I won't give that to you now, but unless you want to hear it, you can ask me about it later. But the Buddha responds in such a way that he says here in Kakayana, who asked the question, he said herein, with this answer, this is not other dependent. So that's a point that the Buddha would raise in various places. It was also at the time of his death, the last little teaching that he gave. He said, be a light unto yourself, betake yourself to no external refuge, hold fast to the truth, look not to anyone other than yourself, or look not to others for refuge, is basically what he said. And so it would seem then, if we have this basic undertaking that we take, if we take up this practice of the Buddha way, the Buddha teaching, Buddha practice, Buddha Dharma, at some point we might want to take refuge. And again, these are part of the 16 precepts that we observe in Soto Zen and in many other schools of Buddhism. And so this might be a little confusing. It might seem to clash with other kinds of teachings that we've received from the Buddha and from ancient time. So what exactly is going on here with this? And in some ways, too, that if we're taking refuge, it's kind of like because we feel insecure, we feel small, we feel separate. There's this huge, vast world out there that we don't fully understand. It can seem very mysterious to us and strange and scary. And so we might, we're almost like little children then, and who might go to mom and dad or to adults anyway, who know better. They know more, and they're bigger, and they seem to know everything, you know. And they're all good. They don't lie, you know, stuff like that. I know when I was a little kid, I didn't think adults lied. Very shocked and disappointed when when I learned differently, but we look to something like that when we feel vulnerable and small and cut off and separate. But this is not the message of the Buddha. Katagiri Roshi, my teacher here, and he told those of us that he gave transmission to. At the very end, the last talk he gave to us, he said, he really was emphatic about this. He said, you are Buddha. It's kind of like, don't forget that. Realize this. And the Buddha said, do not depend on, don't live as though other dependent on other. Dependency on the teacher or some book or scripture or some group of people or a doctrine or a teaching or a school or a judge or a parliament or anything else outside of yourself. Not for the truth, not for understanding Dharma or reality. This is very important. And this is one thing that Katagiri Roshi always used to emphasize, but he really stressed it that evening when he spoke to us the last time he spoke in any kind of a public sense. There were only a few of us assembled there. But he really wanted to, get that point across. So, and yet here, when I took the precepts from him, you know, many years ago now, we would state these precepts as, I take refuge in the Buddha as the perfect teacher. I take refuge in the Dharma as the perfect teaching. Take refuge in the Sangha as a perfect, kind of the perfect refuge of the perfect community, and it wasn't really clear at that time to me, but over time and in thinking about it and how this kind of varied with other kinds of teachings, even teachings I was getting directly from Katagiri Roshi, left some question in my mind about this. So when I give the precepts, particularly in a Jukai ceremony, the formal ceremony of taking the precepts, I want to, you know, say more than just this is taking refuge in the ordinary way that we think of taking refuge, which is actually amplifying and solidifying, reifying our sense of self, separate and apart from other, from the Buddha, from the teaching, from others. And so this is, I think, something that's worth examining here. So the Buddha, this is the way that I state it normally when I'm giving the precepts, at least for the first time, for someone taking lay ordination. I found this passage. I'm not really sure now where I did find it, but it's probably back in my notes somewhere. But rather than just kind of mouthing back words like "I take refuge in the Buddha as the perfect teacher," not really fully understanding what that means or the depth of what is being said there, maybe a little more could be said. And so this is what I give to those who are taking the precepts at that time. I'll say that the Buddha said, "Your refuge is here." He said that right there in that last statement. "Be a light unto yourself, betake yourself to no external refuge, hold fast to the truth, look not for refuge to anyone beside yourself." Buddha's final words. The Buddha said, "Your refuge is here. You need not look further. There's no place else to look. Right here, right now. This is universal and total." And this is what, well, to use a Christian term, I guess, this is what saves us. This is what gives us freedom, is in recognizing this and seeing this. But it is not in a braggadocio sort of way like me, okay, so I, you know, am my own refuge. This isn't it at all. That violates more teachings that we have from the Buddha. And it isn't even that it violates teachings. It violates reality that we can see directly for ourselves. And again, this is what saves us. You can see this. You know this. You know the truth. You know Dharma. It is impossible not to. The problem that we suffer from is that we're confused. And we're confused because we think, we conceptualize our experience, we wrap it up into various concepts and ideas that we'll hold to, and then we start to argue about these various things with each other and others who are following a totally different way. And this is a pretty sad situation. And it also demonstrates a kind of a lack of understanding of the real place that we're in, which is the Dharma, truth, reality. It's right here. It's impossible not to know this. This is all we ever experience, is Dharma. Dharma with a capital D. Truth, reality. And we miss that. It isn't that we're not experiencing that or even that we don't know it. That's actually our direct perceptual experience, really. But we conceptualize the experience. We hold it in forms of ideas and beliefs and things like this. And this is where we go wrong. This book that will be coming out next year, The Grand Delusion, I get into this in that book in some detail about it. It is a grand delusion that we all suffer from unless we wake up to the truth, the reality of our lives. So this is what the Buddha was pointing to, and I think Katagiri Roshi too, and he said, "You are Buddha. Your refuge is here. You see, you know, you have a direct experience of reality, truth, Dharma, right now. It's just a matter of learning to pay attention and to be there present with it." So the Buddha said, "Your refuge is here. You need not look further." You're already having a direct, immediate experience of reality, truth, Dharma. He said, "You need not cling to anything external," as the Buddha said in his final teaching there. And this is called taking refuge in Buddha. So taking refuge in Buddha, remember, is right here in this immediacy. It is available to you now. And you already know this. You know truth. You know Dharma. It isn't something out there that you need to figure out and kind of claw your way to until finally maybe you'll figure this out. This is something that we awaken to. It is a knowledge that we already have, experience that we already have. And it's a matter of just waking up to just what this experience is. So then the Buddha went on. He said that the Buddha, or the enlightened person that you seek, is not apart from where you sit right now. Right where you are sitting now. And always, this is always the case. This is the universal now. It is always now, and you are always sitting right in, well, in Buddha's seat. You are always there. This is you. This is your true self. Your true nature is of this reality. We only miss it because we're distracted by other things and ideas and beliefs and arguments and just on and on it goes. This is the human world, very complicated. Whereas to see reality as immediate and direct is just a matter of really paying attention, learning to pay attention to just this and to not form a lot of ideas about it. We have this story in our tradition, Yakusan Igen, who's in the lineage of Katagiri Roshi, way back there in China. And but Yakusan, he was sitting in meditation, and his teacher, Sekito Kizen, came along and saw him sitting there. And he said, "What are you doing?" And Yakusan said, "I'm not doing anything." So Sekito said, "So you're sitting idly?" And Yakusan said, "Well, if I were sitting idly, I'd be doing something." So then in testing, and then Sekito said, "So what is it you're not doing?" And Yakusan said, "Even Buddhas don't know." Buddhas don't know. We might get the impression then that so for Buddhas it's sort of like, but it's not that. This is referring to conceptual knowledge, having ideas, and ignoring the perceptual direct experience of just this. Buddhas, in other words, Buddhas don't have ideas about enlightenment, about direct reality. They know it and know it directly. And so do you. The difference is because it's just simply that unless we're awake, we're deluded. This is a grand delusion that we're now caught up in the various things that basically what we think and believe. But we're caught by the formed images of not just things and objects, but also, thoughts and feelings as well. And caught by these various things. This, for us, this is the dominant reality, and we're missing the actual immediate direct experience of reality itself. And there's nothing mysterious about this, and you know this. I'll give you just a very simple example. It's not something arcane or far away from you at all. But it's like knowing the taste of orange juice. I can't describe that to you. I'm assuming probably all of you, maybe not all of you, but you've all tasted orange juice, I would assume. Well, maybe you have or you haven't. But if you have, of course, you know. And I think you can also see how you try this yourself. Try to explain this. Describe it to someone else who's never tasted orange juice, the taste, so that they know the taste of orange juice. And you cannot do it. You cannot put it into the conceptual. If you do, you might think you're doing a pretty good job. We have poets who write very beautiful things and inspire us in many ways, but that inspiration is probably leading back to something that you've experienced directly yourself. And you can see what the poet, in a very beautiful and descriptive way, is bringing us back to that kind of an understanding. It's a direct one. And this is where the true knowledge is. And this is what Buddhas know. Buddhas are not confused about. This is just one who's a Buddha. It's just simply a human being who's awake. And but again, this isn't something veiled from you or kept from you. Well, maybe it's sort of like veiled, but it's only veiled because of our ideas and our concepts and our thinking. It's not veiled out of direct experience. And we have this all the time, and it's as direct and simple and easy to understand as knowing the taste of orange juice through a direct experience of tasting. Again, it'll never come to you or to anyone else if you try to give it to somebody by describing orange. You can say it's tangy, it's kind of sweet, it has a beautiful fragrance, the color, all of that. But they won't know orange juice just from your description until they taste it themselves, which is easily done, and it's wordless. There'll be nothing they can really say after that other than, ooh, delicious, or whatever, But they're not going to be able to convey that, the direct experience of that, to someone else. But this is what we do over and over and over again. And so this teaching, Dharma, the second of these, is taking refuge in Dharma. This is taking refuge in and knowing and realizing, waking up to direct experience of reality. It is being experienced in every breathing moment of your life. And we know it to some degree. You know, you have tasted orange juice, and, you know, but we don't really settle into that and realize this is true knowledge. And it differs from what we otherwise think of as knowledge. That this is why Dogen, like in Fukan Zazengi, where he says, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. You know, the, pursuing words and following after speech. Dogen tells us this, you know, directly. Cease from this. Cease from always trying to get it into a conceptual form. Because this takes us away from our actual direct experience of reality. And it also fools us into thinking that, well, now I know it. But you have a conceptual knowledge of that. I would, in my writings that I do, I just give that kind of knowledge a small k, just our ordinary conceptual knowledge. True knowledge is direct experience. And this I would give a capital K to. These are the two truths can be depicted in this way. That's something I bring up in that book. This matter of the two truths is a basic teaching of Nagarjuna, which is pretty important for understanding this kind of a very subtle distinction that can be made between our direct experience, which we pay very little attention to, and our conceptual experience, which we are always involved in. And so this is a very important point. But it's the direct experience. This is the Dharma, the teaching of reality itself is always teaching and showing and demonstrating reality to us. And it's a matter of really waking to that. And it is just simply waking to it, because we've always been having this experience. But it's a matter of finally seeing just what this is, realizing what this is. And then learning to live out of that a little bit more directly. Our conceptual experience, though, it isn't like that's valueless or something. That's extremely important. You know, our intellectual understanding, our conceptual understanding of things. We need this just to get along. For myself to find my, for all of us to find our way here, you know, we have to conceptualize, you know, driving the car or walking or just having some sense of direction or something. But we rely on these various things to, you know, you want to go to the store and buy some tomatoes or something. We can use various concepts with that. You take the tomatoes home and you taste them. Yeah, but there's an aspect of it that's direct and that cannot be, you know, spoken. But so it's almost like kind of a mixture of all of these things. But the conceptual is certainly a part of our life, a very valuable part of our life. And conceptual knowledge is very important. So this isn't to dismiss any of that. But this is a cautioning to just let us know that we don't need to depend on these things quite so much. And at least not if we want to live out of awakeness and out of a direct knowing and understanding of reality. Which again is something that's available to you now, and you do know it. You can fall back into it and realize it. But it is a kind of letting go of the stuff that we cling to, our ideas and beliefs and things like this. We started getting into arguments with other people or something like that, or holding a little different view or something, or even a markedly different view. So this is just attention, you know, coming back to this and waking up to this, realizing what it is we know directly. And this understanding, the Buddha said, is called taking refuge in Dharma. And then he went on, the sanctuary that we seek. This is Sangha now. It's pertaining to Sangha, the third of these of these refuges. The sanctuary we seek is not found anywhere but in the life we live now as all beings. For the awakened, this is what we come to realize and to see, that our life is not just our little life here, separate and apart from others and the world and objects in the world and various doctrines and beliefs and ideologies and other things that cause us to go to war and to fight, even about not necessarily war, but even just in our interactions with other people that can make it, you know, things very difficult for us. To come into this and to live out of this awakeness, this direct experience of reality, is the realization that your life is the life of all beings. All beings is not, and we have this like from the Buddha when he, upon awakening, and he says, I, the great earth, and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. And of course, it isn't just the great earth, it's stars and, you know, trees and rocks and everything. You know, thoughts and feelings of all sorts coming together in this moment. This is what we are. We are this. We are the taste of orange juice, if this is the occasion, the moment. And so it goes for anything else you might otherwise conceptualize and label and, you know, and grasp and think that this is the ultimate, these various things. And all of the reality is in totality. Buddhas never lose sight of totality. This is what they always bear in mind as they are experiencing the various distinct and separate things that we experience here. So the Buddha said, the sanctuary that we seek then is not found anywhere, any particular thing here, but in the life that we live now. And it's always now. There's never then. It's always here and now. And but we live this now, and it's always thus. It's the eternal now. It's always now. But we live this as all beings. And when we begin to see our life as all beings, not as me separate and apart, where there's now something I have to get, something I have to chase after, something I want to run from or block or put down or divide myself from, protect myself from, or whatever. That's seeing the world in a very divisive way, a very fractured way, which is fraught with all kinds of heartache and pain and misery and confusion and anger and hatred and endless. But we're totally caught in the conceptual with all of that. With one real direct awakening to the truth, the reality of our life, this wholeness, this totality, that what we're living out is this life, as all beings, not just with all beings, because we're still seeing ourselves separate. With awakening, it's just this. I, the great earth and all beings, the Buddha said. Simultaneously, all at once, together, realize the great way. We can think too, like, well, wasn't that like 2,500 years ago when the Buddha woke up? You know, and here I am, centuries, millennia later, and I wasn't there, but no. All beings. And there isn't anything left outside of this. But it is a direct seeing, understanding. That's part of the perceptual experience that we tend not to see because we're captured by all the conceptualized, the fractured, the divided. That seems to be overlaying all of that. Again, it isn't that the conceptual is wrong or bad and that we should destroy it. You can't anyway. But we need that. But we don't need to be fooled by that, taken by that. That's the grand delusion, where we're just taken by this and we don't see and realize what's actually being lived out now directly. But this is the life of all beings. And so the Buddha then said that thus receiving these precepts is called taking refuge in Sangha, the life of all beings. And that it is that you're living. It's very good to see that we're living with others, with Sangha. That's, you know, but that's still the conceptual. It is possible to see that even more directly into realizing that ultimately there's no distinction to be made. Katagiri Roshi, again, another interesting teaching that he gave us, where he said, he said the difference between a Buddha and an ordinary being, ordinary human mind, he said, the difference, he says, is huge, vast, vast difference. But then he went on to say, he said, however, he says, but I can't say what it is. kind of like can't really make that distinction. Because in seeing that, we realize that, it's not even that we're all alike. The life that we are truly living is a life of wholeness itself, totality itself. There's no distinction here even to be made in an ultimate sense. Not only with ourselves as human beings, but with the wooden planks on the floor here, or this, you know, this paper that I have here, whatever we encounter. This is what we are, the taste of the orange juice. This is the life that we're living now. It's a life that moment to moment generally escapes us because we're not giving any attention to it. Again, that's settling down to what Yako-san said when he said he was just sitting there, you're not doing anything. So then you're sitting idly. He said, if I was sitting, I'd be doing something. So what is it you're not doing? Sekito asked him, and he said, even Buddhas don't know. They can have ideas about that too, but they're not fooled by them. They're not taken by them. They don't lose sight of the direct experience, which is of wholeness and totality. Well, I think maybe I should pause here then and just see. I think we have to, 9:45 is it or something? Yeah. So I think we have a few minutes here for questions, if you have any questions or comments or anything. Yes.
So the examples you have given are all very concrete and physical. We can talk about our sensory perceptions, mm-hmm. and that's fairly obvious that in a certain way concepts have nothing to do with the fact that that's hard. I can feel that. It gets more complicated when you're talking about events as being experienced.
Yeah.
Such as being here.
Yeah.
So how do we... I can experience the floor being hard by falling down. No concept required. As soon as I have an interaction with a person, there's going to be a concept there.
No, not necessarily.
How do I avoid that?
It's the same thing. Well, but it's all the same. And I did say thoughts and feelings as well, not just physical stuff. But it's just a matter of... Well, how do you know? You know, the easiest thing to notice is that you're caught. You're getting caught. The awakened mind is like a mind of wholeness and totality. And one of the characteristics of a mind like that is that it doesn't lean towards something and away from something else. And this certainly involves our emotions and our thoughts and feelings about things, perhaps even more so than our interaction with physical objects and stuff like that. And what we can notice then about this is that if we can see if we're drawn toward this and away from that, as it says in the Xinjing Ming, it says not hating the world of the senses is synonymous with true enlightenment, and that's by Sansong, the third patriarch of Zen in China, but not hating the world of the senses. If you want to know the one vehicle, I think he says in there, he said, then don't flee from the six dusts. And the six dusts is the samsaric world of this and that and birth and death. And, so the awakened mind is living out of this totality. And it's not really being caught by the distinctions. And the distinctions, by the way, this is consciousness. This is what consciousness is the drawing of distinctions, separations. That's the conceptualizer, dividing one thing from another. We tend to think, since I might take myself as being what's ultimately real along with all of you and various things that are out there, so I seem to be something here separate, and then I have this consciousness that takes things in. This is kind of how we see it. Unless we wake up, the awakened don't see it that way at all. What they see is that there's this world of wholeness, and consciousness is what divides this wholeness into this and that and the next thing. And there's these divisions are physical, but they're also emotional, mental in various ways, and they're also temporal. And that's a big area there. I guess I was going to say more, but I better not, because that's a huge area. But this is what consciousness is. This is the conscious experience that we have, and it's the objects that are broken out, whether it's the hardness of the floor not even the word, the hardness, but the actual knowing of that, the experiencing of that, or the biting sting of hate, or, you know, somebody slandered you in some way, or whatever, you know, things like this, or the wonderful feeling of love, or the various things that might come over us. And we'll label those and kind of solidify their separations and differences from other sorts of things. You know, and we're very very skilled at doing that, and we do that so quickly and so automatically, and we think that the world is of that nature. But what we can awaken to is that the true nature, before all of this conceptual distinctions are being made, is this world of oneness, this world of totality. Sometimes people, when they first experience that, they think that this is enlightenment. You know, all is one. You know, like the Zen hot dog, the guy goes to get the hot dog and he says, make me one with everything. And we think like, so we think like this is what enlightenment is. Well, it's maybe a necessary step, but, and I don't know if I want to use the term step, but it's a necessary component to all of this. But ultimately, what we can awaken to is that the dusty world, this fractured world, this divided world, is not other than the world of oneness and totality. And that's the true awakening there. And this includes everything that can be named and labeled. That's our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our sensations, you know, as well as the objects and concepts and theories and things that we might encounter or drum up or whatever. So I don't know if I answered your question or not.
You answered a lot of questions. I'm going back to like our present political situation.
Yeah.
I don't feel that I can simply say, well, I embrace all this because I'm one with
it. No, I'm not saying that.
At some point, I will act. I will express myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And my expression, my actions will depend on concepts I have and ways that I'm using.
They don't have to, is what I'm saying. Okay. They don't have to. You can. They can be. They can be. That's the word I want. They can be. But they can come out of an understanding, a seeing of this fractured situation. Yeah, we're in a horrendous situation right now. What's going on in the human world, and that is all of our making by people clinging to their various views and ideas and thoughts and feelings about various things. And what is good and what is bad. And, you know, even just going back to the event in 2001 of the flying of the planes into those buildings in New York, you know, well, if you look at the people, and we probably most of us, I think all of us, would just see that as a very horrendous, you know, horrible thing. And definitely wrong, you know, not good. Whereas the people who did that, probably, I suspect from what I've read about this anyway, they probably thought they were doing something good and acting in accordance with what God would dictate and want them to do and all this sort of thing. And then they can go, yeah, I think they had ideas and beliefs that they would immediately go to heaven and have all these wonderful, you know, things available to them. And so they're acting out of ideas like that. But that's what we do. We act out of our ideas and our beliefs. And, of course, now that's a pretty stark difference there, but we can get into other things that might seem a little bit more subtle as to, well, what is good or bad here? Now, there's an interesting, it's a Taoist story, it's about the wise Chinese farmer. Do you know that story? The wise Chinese farmer, one day his horse ran off, and his neighbor came to commiserate with him, and, you know, he lost his horse, you know. And the farmer said, well, who can say what's good or bad? And the next day, the horse comes back, and she brought with her some more horses. And so now the neighbor comes over and congratulates him on his good fortune. He's got all these horses now. And the farmer said, well, who can say what's good or bad? The next day, his son breaks his leg trying to break one of the horses. So the neighbor comes by to commiserate. The farmer would only say, who can say what's good or bad? The next day, the army came through the... passed by his son because he had a broken leg, and then the farmer comes to there's no end to this story. And of course, it isn't just the situation that the farmer or his neighbor are in. We're all in this, and we're saying, well, this is good and this is bad. I can think of things in my life that were horrendous at the time, Even now, thinking back on what a sad situation that was, I lost my father when I was 6 years old, suddenly and unexpectedly, you know. And yet, at the same time, I can also see, you know, not just particularly from this event, but there's all kinds of things that we've all experienced this, that at the time might seem like this is really bad, this is not good. And yet, at the same time, some wonderful, amazing things can come from some of these experiences. And the reverse is true, too. We think, well, this is great, this is wonderful what just happened here now. And then some really awful things might occur, you know, from that. But again, the story is never over. But when we're always reaching for the thing that we can grasp and label and, you know, we think this is good or bad or this is what I want to work toward, this is not working out or living out of wholeness. I'm only here to say that those who are awake don't operate in this way. They see things in totality, and that kind of softens they're lunging toward one thing and to embrace one thing and to get rid of another and that sort of thing. But it isn't to abandon that or to kill that. The world of distinctions and separation doesn't end. But it's a matter of to what degree are we going to allow ourselves to be caught, and to be caught in ways where we don't even realize we're caught. And where we might be thinking, well, I'm doing good and I'm a good person, all this, you know, because we want to be. We genuinely want to be. And we genuinely think we're doing something wonderful and good. This will slow us down, caution us there, and to look at this in a larger perspective and see just where we are. It is not about straightening out the world, however, but it is about straightening up ourselves. So we're not constantly being tossed about by this and that. And then as we move through the world, maybe we can you know, help somebody. So, I don't know. Is that a?
If you want to, well, we got a few moments.
Well, and any other question? Did I answer you there? Okay. All right. Yes.
Good and bad reminds me of a story I heard a long time ago. Because fortunately, three men were flying in an airplane. Unfortunately, one man fell out. Fortunately, there was a haystack below. Unfortunately, there was a pitchfork in the haystack. Fortunately, you missed the pitchfork. Unfortunately, you missed the haystack.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that's kind of how it goes, you know. So the good and bad, I could say this about that, though. The 183rd verse of the Dhammapada, the early record that we have of sayings of the Buddha, in that verse is where he says, do what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome. Purify your own mind. This is about this leaning stuff I was talking about. Purify your own mind. And then he said, this is the teaching of the awakened. There it is in a nutshell. And so he's talking about wholesome and unwholesome, not good or bad. Though I've seen some translations where it's cast in that way. That's not really the best way to take the term out of the Pali, which is probably where originally, or the Sanskrit. But to see things in terms of wholeness, or what is fractured, unwhole, it's not of the whole. It's of, like, me, the self, the part, but also of my community, my this or that, or my religion and my politics, or, you know. But where we're coming out of a fractured view, that is always pain and suffering and confusion and anger and hatred. It just perpetuates and perpetuates and perpetuates. We can see things in terms of the whole. And so that's why the Buddha said in that line, in that verse, 183rd verse, Dhammapada, you can look it up. But he said, do what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome, avoid. There's no commandments here. Well, I was going to say that about the precepts here too, but never mind. We don't have time now. But I got to talk again. Maybe I'll say something about that. But to avoid, you know, avoid what is unwholesome. And then he said, purify your own mind. Pay attention to what you're doing here. Your own grasping, and you know, even Jesus talked this way about, you know, seeing the mote in your neighbor's eye without addressing or paying attention to the plank, I think he said, in your own eye, which I can't quite visualize. But it's that sort of thing. And, you know, and then, and also to do this non-judgmentally. And don't judge others with the idea, well, good and bad. And of course, we're our tendency then will come from the point of view that I'm good. Of course, we can flip that on ourselves and think, I'm bad, and then we have a wretched view of ourselves, and that isn't very helpful either. So to just recognize what is out of the wholesome. And in yourself, you're not in the picture, you're not being tugged around one way or another by this or that. Avoid the fractured, the unwholesome, and purify your own mind. You have to do it. I have to do it. For each of us, this is your work. This is our work. We have to take it up ourselves. And then he said, this is the teaching of the awakened. As if to just say, this is it right here it is in a nutshell. He abbreviates it even further in a different teaching that we have of the Buddha into one word. And he said, awareness. Somebody asked him to sum up his teaching in a single word, and he said, awareness. But that's awareness with a capital A, meaning not awareness of anything in particular, but just living out of awakeness. So, maybe one more or something, I don't know. you can call it, Ben.
We should
better wrap it up. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you.